The Bookhouse is an independent bookstore with two locations in New Jersey, Millburn and Long Branch. Are you the guy who says they like to support indie bookstores? Good. Then be that guy. Come shop at The Bookhouse. Books, puzzles, games, coffee, cards, live author events, comedy nights, and most important, a real sense of community where actual human beings engage with one another. The Bookhouse in downtown Millburn and at Pier Village in Long Branch. That's The Bookhouse. Independent, local, quaint as fuck. Follow us on Instagram and come visit our stores.
Hello, everyone. It's your old pal, Neil Pollack, the greatest living American writer and the editor-in-chief of Book and Film Globe, www.bookandfilmglobe.com, your one-stop shop for all things about books and film and streaming TV. We are a product of Sea of Reeds Media, which also owns two terrific independent bookstores in New Jersey. One is the Bookhouse in Millburn, and the other one is on the Jersey Shore in Long Branch, also called the Bookhouse. You should check them out if you are in the area and support your local independent booksellers. But we're going to talk about movies this week. It's been a huge week at the box office for films, and just in terms of the diversity of content, you really can't beat what's out there. We're going to talk about three of the movies that are out this week. We're going to talk to Stephen Garrett, our chief film critic, about Robert Eggers' Nosferatu, and also about Baby Girl, which is a erotic comedy thriller type thing starring Nicole Kidman. And I'm also going to talk to contributor Jim Arndorfer, our resident Bob Dylan expert, about the Bob Dylan biopic, A Complete Unknown, which is in theaters now. I've seen it twice. I may see it again. It's really good. A lot of fun. Very mainstream for a Bob Dylan movie, and I think is the front runner to be the best picture winner at the Oscars this year. But first, we're going to talk to Stephen Garrett. I'm going to summon him from his crypt, and we're going to talk about Nosferatu.
He's coming.
He is coming.
Stephen Garrett, I summon you to speak with me.
You awakened me from an eternity of darkness.
All right, well, we're not actors. We don't do a good Nosferatu imitation, but there's lots of mystical incantations in Nosferatu, Robert Eggers' adaptation of the classic vampire tale, which is befuddling and amazing cinemagoers all over the world as we speak. Stephen and I both saw this movie and, you know, both, I think, got were sort of ironically entertained by it more than we wanted to be.
That's fair. I did not want to be ironically entertained.
No. I will say, my wife and I went to see it as we were talking a couple of nights ago, and we both had some criticisms of the movie, but we both had like very weird dreams the night. Ooh. We saw a late showing, like a 9:15 showing, and so we were in bed, you know, fairly soon after the movie was over. And it's not like we dreamt of
in your coffins, in your side by side coffins.
No, we did draw the blackout shades in our bedroom, but it's not like we dreamt of being, you know, ravished by a moldy old man with a mustache.
As one does.
I'm like, Grandpa, what are you doing in the castle? Gosh. So Nosferatu, look. Here's what I'll say, Stephen, is, you know, this is a very interesting looking movie, right?
Oh, it looks magnificent. I mean, really looks fantastic.
The period details, there's some beautiful shots when they're like rowing down that canal in Germany or the scene where Nicholas Holt's character is like going up to the castle in that creepy carriage.
Yeah.
Good stuff. Like really like cool homage to German expressionism. And I've read several pieces talking about how lovingly Robert Eggers, the director, you know, paid attention to the period details, the sets, the costumes, the diction, how they used Frau, the word Frau, because this takes place mostly in Germany. You know, there's some good stuff in Nosferatu. I mean, I critique it because I love it.
There's a lot to love, but I I keep thinking back. It's unintentionally campy. Let's just put it that way. I think there's intentional campiness. Like, I think Coppola leaned into the campy aspects of Dracula. Gary Oldman's Dracula was hilarious and kind of wonderful. I'm not really too sure what tone Skarsgård is going for with his weird, you know, moldy Cossack with the walrus mustache vibe. Like, yeah, just like, yeah. what are you in your crazy raspy voice, which I dug, but also seemed, you know, like, he'd say, here's one line I love. I am most impatient to bring my eyes on your covenant papers. Like, if there's a way to say it, simply, he avoids at all costs. He makes everything sound elaborate.
It would have been nice to have seen him not in shadow one time, too. Mm. I guess at the end, when he hits the sunlight hits him.
Definitely not in shadow then, yeah.
No, but, you know... Well, I would say it was not entirely unintentionally campy. I mean, Willem Dafoe
knows what he's where he's at. Maybe Willem is like, I'm sizing this up. I think this is what this film needs. I'm going to lean into it because, you know, it's a little self-serious. That's the problem. It's very self-serious.
Yeah.
Eggers, I think, obsessed about making this movie for so long that I think it became this almost holy relic to him.
Yeah, but then he brings in Willem Dafoe in the second half as this wacky occult expert / vampire hunter. And Willem Dafoe, like, refuses to not just, like, go full-on crazy speech.
He's fantastic.
Yeah, you know, what was the line? He's like, I have seen things in my time that would make Isaac Newton crawl back into the womb. I'm like, oh.
I mean, clearly somebody's having fun, and Eggers, I'm sure, was having fun writing some of these lines. Like, I think there was a point where Eggers was maybe loosening up and having a bit of a gas, but I don't know. There are just certain, like, the whole conceit of Lily Rose Depp being possessed and shaking, constantly convulsing. I was like, why is this necessary? In service of what? You just, like, I like the idea of this mental connection that the two of them had. I love the idea that he represents this thing that she desires, but she's completely ashamed by it. He is the manifestation of her shame, I guess, of whatever sexual shame she might feel or shame about her sexuality. But, and that's what vampires are, right? And certainly Dracula, like, is a very horny guy or rather gets everybody super horny around him, right? He's a very randy vampire. But one of the things that I love the most about Bram Stoker's book was that it's told through letters and it's told through the retelling through other people's points of view, and you never hear Dracula speak, and you never know his thoughts, and you never know what his intentions are. He is just an absolute projection of everything else. And in this movie does what, again, like what Bram Stoker's, I mean, what Coppola's Dracula did, which is he made it kind of a love story, and he made him a bit of a simp. Like, I envy your love for her, you know. Come on.
Right. But the problem is he envies his love for Lily Rose Depp, who, as you put it so cleverly in your review, is about as voluptuous as a stalk of celery.
She's a waif. I mean, she's definitely a waif or a sylph, right? Isn't that what
I mean, yes, of course she's a beautiful woman, but it's like, but I'm like, this is the object of your eternal lust. I mean, she can't even act.
Hey, everybody's got a type. I don't know. I guess mine would be Isabella Gianni or like Monica Bellucci or any of the other women who, you know, Dracula kind of woos and commands under his spell.
Well, you know, my wife and I were looking up Francis Ford Coppola's Dracula, you know, the Sadie Frost, who he ravishes in 1992. you know, how about Catherine Deneuve? Catherine Deneuve has been horny for The Hunger. They've been horny for her in vampire movies. Or who is George Hamilton's object of lust in Love at First Bite? My favorite Dracula movie, Susan St. James.
I mean, let's just, like, I don't want to, you know, like the celery stalk thing, like, notwithstanding, I don't think there's necessarily a body type that equals sexy, but
of course,
do think you need to be an inherently sexy, sensual person. And I just don't think, at least for me, Lily Rose Depp kind of falls short of it.
I think that she is sexy, but I don't think she's a particularly good actress. So it's like, that's what it comes down to, is like whether or not she's a physically attractive is immaterial. Almost everyone in movies is physically attractive compared to the average population. But it's like, that's why they're in a movie. But, you know, there's a lot of her, you know, and there's a lot of her moaning around writhing in the sheets for hours, it seems, before Dracula, for weeks and for months before Dracula or Nosferatu or whatever the hell his name is, arrives in Germany. Also, I wasn't entirely sure about this plague conceit that they went with.
It feels like it's a little shortchanged there by the end, yeah. I mean, you know, like the first 40 minutes or so is very faithful to the original 1922 film, and I feel is very kind of slavishly devoted to reimagining that whole thing, and it really kind of moves nice, and it's tight, and all that kind of stuff. And then towards the end, I just kind of feel like, wait, what is the plague thing again, and how is this working, and what is this conceit, and the wheels kind of fall off a little.
And how does Willem Dafoe know all this stuff? You know, he finds this book, this codex or whatever. There are some things that were a little confusing. Yeah. That said, you know, it's kind of fun to me, Stephen, that Nosferatu, you know, in 2024, late 2024, is, you know, a pretty popular movie. This is an art house movie. There is no. Like this is not like some kind of like mainstream Lost Boys Hollywood vampire thing,
you know. And yet, I feel like he is doing these kind of cheap thrill, you know, kind of mainstream movie jump scares and big shocking bursts of music and all this stuff that I just feel kind of is cheap. Like, he's made scary movies before, and he hasn't had to kind of fall back on these things as much as he's doing here.
Yeah, but you look at Eggers' last movie, The Northman, which I, you know, that was a real piece of work. Viking
hit. It was swing and a miss, but I mean, it was a big swing, and it was big, and there was a lot of braggadociousness to it. I mean, it's very much a study of masculinity, like all of his movies are. Right. Actually, I think what's nice about this is that it's taking the female point of view, and it's exploring the kind of idea of female desire and sensuality and yearning and its relationship to men.
But you have this filmmaker who's like, you know, a true artist, right? Who is like inching toward mainstream respectability, which is kind of interesting to watch as far as I'm concerned.
Totally is. I think it's great. Look, I was mixed on it, obviously. I wished it were better. I love Eggers and I love the movies he's done before. Not everyone completely clicks for me, but more often than not, they do. I thought The Lighthouse was amazing. I thought The Witch was amazing. Northman didn't completely hit the mark for me, but has some bonkers moments in it. And this has some bonkers moments too. I just felt like I was never scared. I found the Count kind of silly. I thought the makeup and the conception of him was kind of silly. I thought there were way too many jump scares. Nothing really felt eerie. It just felt too polished and too slick.
Then why did I wake up on my lawn this morning?
I can't get into that, man. I can't tell you.
In a daze. I was in an absolute
covered
daze.
In blood.
I hope it was blood. God. Anyway, Stephen Garrett has been summoned to review Nosferatu, and we will once again awaken him from his slumber next week to talk about something else.
Yes, evermore.
We have one more act for you this evening. I don't even need to say his name.
How does it feel?
Mr. Bob Dylan.
To have you on your own.
200 people in that room, and each one wants me to be somebody else.
What do you want to be?
Whatever it is they don't want me to be.
Like a rolling stone.
Our most trafficked post of the year was not a movie review, but sort of a movie preview of the Bob Dylan biopic, A Complete Unknown, which is in theaters now. Jim Arndorfer is our resident Dylanologist, and he wrote something about the trailer and how it looked like it was going to fall prey to every music biopic cliche that Walk Hard, the Dewey Cox story, made fun of 10 years ago. And now the movie is out, and I don't know. I mean, well, Jim is here with me, first of all. Hello, Jim.
Hey, Neil.
Hey, so first of all, I don't know. I mean, I feel like I wouldn't say you were wrong in saying that the Dylan movie looked like it was going to hit a lot of biopic cliches, because it does. But I saw this movie, and I love this. I think this is a great movie. And you wrote a review of it for us. And you also, it's a slight mea culpa on your part, I would say.
Yeah, I'd say. Yeah, I mean, a biopic is a biopic, so it's going to have some tropes, right? You know, I mean, singer, you know, trying to get to the right word while, you know, writing on a desk late at night, lady love in the background, or, you know, a moody song where Pans do a jilted lover, things like that. But yeah, I thought Mangold and Cox did a good job in coming up with a story that felt fresh, well-paced, really good performances, musical and otherwise, by Chalamet and crew. You know, I had some other beefs, but as a movie, yeah, I thought it worked. I thought it was an entertaining romp. The audience I saw it with Christmas Day in St. Louis Park, Minnesota, applauded not once, but twice.
You saw it in Minnesota, which is where Bob Dylan is from.
I did, yeah.
Little hometown feel to it. Yeah, I mean, the thing is, like, I think even more than your average musical biopic, this was a musical. Like, the numbers just kind of erupted. And there was a lot of music in this movie. I mean, a lot.
Yeah, there was. Actually, more than, you know, yeah. I mean, more than I would have thought. I think that's one reason it's really gone over well with audiences, right? I mean, it takes, you know, the man put together some pretty good songs in a pretty short span of time. Yeah, there's, you know, a lot of nostalgia in the room when people see it. And then, you know, people are bringing along their kids. So it's a good generation marker right now.
Well, yeah, that's the thing. What I like about it is that, yeah, yes, obviously it appeals to the olds. It's Bob Dylan, after all. I mean, he's not some hip new phenomenon. But it also stars Timothy Chalamet, who is a hip new phenomenon. You know, Willy Wonka himself, Paul Atreides, basically like our biggest. He's basically like our biggest movie star. This little guy.
Yeah, he's good at playing false messiahs, man. That's true.
Yeah, right. But I thought he was really good at playing Bob Dylan.
Yeah, 100%, 100%. I mean, he captured the charm, captured the sullenness, the whole deal, you know?
The enigmatic qualities of our Nobel laureate.
Exactly, but also, you know, wide-faced at times, you know? I mean, I thought the scene of him just, you know, stepping off the car in New York City or going into the hospital to meet Woody for the first time, just looking down these, you know, long hallways, it caught a wide range. He nailed it across the board.
Well, and there's a scene I love too. Well, first of all, yeah, Ed Norton is sort of your, I guess, your second lead here. He plays Pete Seeger, who I thought he was terrific as a sort of that sort of the gee whiz previous generation of sincere folk singers. But there's a scene Pete Seeger hosts this PBS folk music show, basically like this local, almost like a public access show. So, you know, cheap. And he's playing with this old blues dude, this old drunk blues dude. And Bob Dylan walks in and there's a scene where Bob Dylan and this blues guy play guitar together and Pete Seeger picks up the banjo. I thought that scene was really good. Like, I'm like, that was something like that did not need to be in the biopic, you know?
Yeah. And I to your point, I mean, I think that's one of the things that kept it fresh, right? Scenes like that, scenes that, you know, felt like real life, unrehearsed. And yeah, I mean, there was like some hesitancy to the scene, right? I mean, was he going to go on? Was he not going to go on? You know, how was Pete going to react? How was the blues guy going to react? All that. So, it kept what could have been a stale production fresh.
Yeah, and you know, I would say like the another thing that to me, I mean, I'm only a man. Another thing that kept the stale production fresh was a lot of scenes of Monica Barbaro as Joan Baez in her underwear, basically just like walking around like in negligees, like singing with Bob Dylan. That scene where they sing "Blowing in the Wind" in Dylan's apartment, you know, that's a great scene.
Yeah, no, totally. And you know, there's like a wide range of things happening there, right? I mean, there's a definite tensions and definite passive aggressive hostility as well. But yeah, I mean, it adds up to a, you know, a cinema verite might be going a little far, but yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it wasn't verite, but it was like two beautiful people at the height of their beauty, singing very well, you know, scantily clothed. And not only that, singing one of the greatest songs ever written.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
A song that I never thought like Blowing in the Wind or Like a Rolling Stone, or, you know, some of the, or Mr. Tambourine Man. I never thought those would feel fresh to me again, you know?
Did they?
Maybe not.
Hearing them in this context?
Maybe not fresh. Not fresh, but like exciting. Like I was enthusiastically listening to them in a way that I hadn't in, you know, since perhaps I was a teenager, right?
Yeah, it gave them a different kind of life, right? Different context. Yeah, I mean, I would agree with that. You know, I did listen to some of the soundtrack before, and I think they sound better seen than versus liberated, you know, versus just listened to, if you will. I think there's definitely a performative energy that adds to them.
Yeah, they're not Joan Baez and Bob Dylan at the end of the day. They're Ed Norton is not Pete Seeger. These are actors, but they're really, really good performances. So I think
They sell it. I mean, they sell the hell out of any performance they do. Totally.
Yeah. So, you know, it was, I felt like they were really enthusiastic about it. Now, as a Dylanologist, you had some sort of quibbles with some of the choices that James Mangold made.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not as serious a Bob Dylan fan as you are. I went to see him earlier this year in Austin. I had a nice nap.
Okay.
I mean,
he was old, and
I didn't recognize a lot of the music, and it was very kind of obscure and obtuse, and it was not the most amazing show I've ever been to. But I got to see him live. But I guess I'm not really like well informed about why this wasn't the picture perfect accurate Dylan movie. But maybe you could shine a little light on that.
Yeah, I mean, a biopic's going to be an adaptation of a life, right? And, you know, any director, any writer has a lot of choices to make. So, you know, it's not going to be a documentary, and there's going to be you got to play fast and loose with some facts if you're going to fill even 5 years of someone's life in, 2 hours and 20 minutes. So, yeah, I mean, I'm not going to nitpick over, you know, like how they portrayed some things happening at the Newport Folk Festival that didn't actually happen there, or, you know, Albert Grossman and Alan Lomax did get in a fist fight, but it was because Lomax gave kind of a, you know, condescending intro to when the Paul Butterfield band went on stage. You know, it had nothing to do with the Dylan performance. The one major one, which happens early in the film, which I did take issue with, might be a little bit strong, but more kind of like, huh, that's weird, is you know, when Bob goes to see Woody for the first time shortly upon arriving in New York, which is true, how exactly it went down is open to conjecture, but yeah, I think within the first week of arriving in New York, he went out to visit his hero Woody.
Woody Guthrie,
yes, thank you. It's been a few years. you know, in this telling, Pete Seeger's in the room. Bob plays the song, appropriately sung to Woody, his own composition. And, you know, Woody and Pete's eyes light up as if, you know, they found, you know, the new Messiah. And Pete takes him home and, you know, puts him up. And, you know, next morning, Bob is, you know, playing an early work in progress of one of his later greater songs. I can't remember exactly what one it is right now. I'm sorry, but
it was either Blowing in the Wind or one or the other one.
Yeah. And you know, like one of Seeger's kids, like yeah, nice start or something like that. And you know, what kind of little biopic.
Yeah.
Also totally not true, you know. I mean, like, my main beef, as it were, with the movie is it makes Bob look like he's a fully formed artist when he arrives in New York City from Minnesota, which is like wholly not true. I mean, he was not the best folk singer in Minnesota. He wasn't the best folk singer in Dinkytown. You know, he was a raw product when he showed up, and, you know, he worked hard to get good. He stole a lot of ideas from a lot of people. He watched, he learned, you know, he had self-confidence and ambition to burn, and, you know, he worked hard, he made it. And one thing that people would note is like how fast he grew, you know, I mean, like how it was, you know, like Robert Johnson deal with the devil situation, you know, like this unpolished kid shows up one day and then, you know, a few, you know, some months later, he's killing it. So I think that misses a big part of the story.
I think that's a good point. That's a good point. Like you never saw him have a disastrous session, right?
Right. Yeah, exactly.
It would have been easy for the movie to do that, right? It'd still be the same movie.
Yeah, I think so. And, you know, I mean, there's pitfalls in that too, right? I mean, that can get cheesy. I mean, I do wonder if the reason they stayed, I mean, they made a clear decision to stay away from that, right? And, you know, I mean, I think that kind of amps up the conflict between him and Seeger, because it makes it look like Seeger's wholly responsible for his, you know, rise, and then Bob turns on him. you know, I also wonder if they, you know, avoided that whole scene because of a, you know, a movie called, you know, Inside Llewyn Davis by the Coen brothers, which, you know, covers very similar territory in that scene around the same time, a movie in which a Bob-like figure appears at the very end. And, you know, what, you know, whether they didn't want to go down that road because of that. I mean, I don't know. They made the choices they did, but.
Well, this is, you know, it's interesting. Like, I would consider rewatching Inside Llewyn Davis because, you know, obviously that's a much more cynical, darker take on the New York folk scene than this thing, which is like basically like a rousing songbook musical. It's not like it lacks depth. It's not like there's not drama. You know, like you said, the conflict between Bob and the old guard folkies is more than enough to drive the story forward. But it, you know, the movie, like, if there are any chuckles, they're kind of incidental, and it, just because of, you know, Chalamet's line readings are so good sometimes.
You just have to
kind of admire it. You know, I hate to break it to you, but I think this might be a front runner for Best Picture.
Yeah, I could totally see that.
Because, you know, it's good enough for sure, and it's got broad appeal, and it's got big stars, at least one big star, and then, you know, some excellent character actors. I feel like it's got a shot, and Hollywood loves their musical biopics.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, for what it is, it's great, right? And, I mean, I wasn't, like, hate watching it. I wasn't seething while it was going on. I was entertained. I mean, I think there's a better story that could have been told. But, I mean, it was not for lack of quality in the way the picture on the screen was being executed, for sure.
I'm surprised. I will admit it, you know. I'm surprised because we've seen a lot of sort of very corny musical biopic. I mean, you know, the best ones were like the Elton John movie and Bohemian Rhapsody, you know, and those had a lot of problems. And then the bad ones like the Bob Marley movie or that Amy Winehouse film that came out, you know.
It's been a rough season for sure. But yeah, I mean, I think by sticking to the music, I think they definitely dodged that.
All right. Well, Jim, I'm going to let you go back to listen to the basement tapes in your basement. And thank you for covering the year of Dylan for us so well.
All right, man. Appreciate it. Take care.
So how did it start?
I see myself as a
power hungry personality.
You think that's what I am?
I think you like to be told what to do.
Your behavior is unacceptable.
Is it? If we're gonna do this, we need to set some rules that you and I both agree on.
Did you order this?
Starting with, I tell you what to do and you do it.
It's been quite a holiday week at the box office, dominated by three movies for children. Mufasa, the Lion King sequel, Sonic the Hedgehog 3, and Moana 2 are all doing blockbuster business, but this is a program for adults, and we talk about movies with adult themes. So we have talked about A Complete Unknown, about young Bob Dylan. We have talked about Nosferatu, about old Dracula, and now we're going to talk about the most adult of all the adult movies currently in theaters right now. I'm talking about Baby Girl,
This isn't a kids movie, Baby Girl?
There's a couple of teenagers in it, but those are not kids. Those
no
are
babies.
No babies.
Oh, right. No babies. Yeah, surly teens. I forgot.
Yeah, so Stephen Garrett and I, naturally, our two middle-aged men are going to be talking about a movie about middle-aged repressed female desire.
Perfect.
What do we know? We're at best the low rent versions of Antonio Banderas' character.
Oh, poor guy.
What for him? What a simp! What a cuck!
Oof!
Cinema's ultimate cuck, Antonio Banderas. He plays a theater director who probably gets more praise than the average avant-garde theater director. That's a very large theater for that pretentious play he was staging.
Huge theater, yeah. No, he's enormous. He's enormous in the world of Baby Girl.
Yeah,
there's a lot of suspended disbelief in this movie. Can I just say
it's a fantasy for sure. So Nicole Kidman plays Romy Mathis, who is the CEO of some kind of robotics company that for some reason that is based in Manhattan, which is not where a robotics company would be based, but she's like a very, very wealthy corporate genius. And she and Antonio Banderas have these two teenage daughters, and they live in a... Is your Manhattan apartment look like theirs, Stephen?
No. No, it does not. It does not. But you know what? Yeah, their offices look very much like the A24 offices, incidentally.
Yeah.
Trivia note. The whole thing was shot in A24's offices, all the corporate stuff. Those are their offices.
Yeah, the offices looked good, but although they didn't look really... A24's offices in New York?
Yeah, they just moved into this new office building. It's super corporate and polished. And
yeah, I liked the office. The office setting was good. And then they also live in... I guess it's Connecticut. They live in, is it upstate New York? I don't know where it is, but they live in a...
It feels like a... Yeah, like a country house, right?
They have a very, very large, lavish country house. I mean, she's very wealthy, so that makes sense. But the movie basically... revolves around her relationship with this sexy male intern played by Harris Dickinson, who is a very appealing actor. You know, I can see why she went for him. And it basically, like, she has these repressed desires. It's not really an S&M movie, right, Steven? It's like she just wants to be, because, you know, their sex is actually pretty gentle, but she wants to be told what to do.
I mean, as far as I could tell, there's a sex montage where they basically kind of dance around and laugh and hold each other and kiss in a fancy hotel room, right? Am I misremembering?
Yeah, and there's a couple others. If you want to see a movie where Nicole Kidman lays on the floor and gets fingered,
there's that moment too. Yeah,
there's quite a bit of Nicole Kidman orgasm face.
Yeah.
In the movie. You know, whatever, she's good, and she certainly doesn't pretend to be anything other than her age. Like, you see her bony knees and her, like, you know, her. You know, she gets Botox, but I mean, she looks her age. Harris Dickinson, the character, like, he's an appealing actor, but I felt like his character was very thin.
It's a little bit of a projection, right? Like, it's kind of like, I guess this is a baby girl's fantasy of what this guy would be, who's kind of dominating, but also kind of
gentle.
He's a little gentle. He's a little wireframed. He's not like a beefy, hunky guy. He's kind of like a little willowy kind of guy. A lot of soft features.
Yeah, soft features. He's like from an indie rock band or something. So, you know, I in my review on Book and Film Globe, he's like a male version of a manic pixie dream girl, right? Like,
yeah.
You know, the thing is, like, Antonio Banderas, I mean, they've been married for 19 years. He's always telling Nicole Kidman that he loves her, but then asking her to do chores. and make phone, you know, and like order presents and stuff. And so she has all these domestic duties, and her lover doesn't want anything from her other than for her to drink a glass of milk that he orders for her at a bar.
And like eat a dog biscuit out of her hand or whatever, right? Or out of
It was a hotel room candy, but it was basically supposed to be. So, you know, she wants to be his dog, but but it's not like, it's a very gentle master pet relationship, and I feel like the movie doesn't really do a great job of, like, developing their relationship, right? It shows it, but you don't really feel like they have anything in common. It's very strange.
It is very strange. I actually kind of like that part of it, like that scene you mentioned before with the finger.
Yeah.
right. It's preceded with some really kind of hilarious dialogue where he's trying to be domineering and talk dirty, and she's kind of like, what? And then he kind of breaks it, like, isn't this what you want, or don't you want? What do you want? Like, I kind of laughed at that point. It was kind of refreshing to see two people stumble into whatever kind of relationship they're both figuring out works for them.
Right. But she gives a speech. She gives a speech toward the end where she talks about how, this is something that's been in her entire life. Like,
right.
This is like her erotic identity. And she's sort of been play acting. Not her professional life, but like her domestic life has been sort of play acting, right?
Well, and it also has one of these great toss off lines, like, "Oh, I was raised in a cult," and you're like, "Wait, what? Hang on, can you unpack that a little bit?" Like,
right.
There's a lot that's kind of, oh, her crazy acting. I mean, the way her desires are messed up because she had a messed up childhood, which we're not going to explain.
Right. Well, and also, like, we don't really know much about Harris Dickinson's character. Like, where does he live? He works at a fancy cocktail lounge when he's not an intern at this robotics company. Okay, that's fine, but where is that? You know.
Also, what kind of robotics company? First of all, some kind of robotics company puts it perfectly. You have no idea. They're just like robots. So okay, let's not even get into that. But then, you know, also they have an internship program that starts in early December, and then suddenly everybody goes on holiday break. Like, it's just. This whole thing is such a fantasy. It's so contrived, the whole movie.
It's always Christmas in this movie.
It's always Christmas. It's the endless It is the longest Christmas movie you've ever seen. It goes on for about 3 months, Christmas, apparently.
Or it's there's two Christmases, but it doesn't really give you a sense. It doesn't really exist in reality, but it's also not really a fantasy.
Right. It's neither fish nor fowl. I don't know. It was a problem I had with the movie, and I like the idea of the movie. I like the intent of the movie. I like a lot of the scenes in the movie, but as a story, it's kind of preposterous, and maybe that's okay. I do feel like there's this sort of like, take me seriously. No, don't take me that seriously. This is only a movie, but it's addressing really serious things.
Well, and that's fine. But and it had some of the elements of like the classic 80s erotic thrillers like Fatal Attraction or The Hand That Rocks the Cradle or this, you know, although those kinds of films that were a huge genre back in the day. But it's not, it's really more of an indie comedy. It's not really that. So I just felt like there are problems with the pacing and the screenplay. Like and it's okay for him to make sort of a comic, you know, role reversal on those kinds of movies, but it didn't hit the beats well enough. It was too film festival-y, too art house-y, too indie. So I think that I feel like giving it a mainstream release around Christmas up against like a torrent of popular films, two extremely popular films for adults and a bunch of popular films for kids. I just kind of think it's dooming Baby Girl to the remainder bit in a lot of ways.
Oh, maybe. I don't know. I kind of hope that there's, look, movies are back, right? They're back. Everybody loves movies.
Sure,
again.
They're back. Why not? They never went away for me, but yes.
There's popular stuff that people seem to want to go to, right? Like the kids have a bunch of different choices. The adults have a bunch of choices, and this is one of them. I mean, anecdotally, I've heard people were excited about seeing this, and you know, there was a packed audience for it in one friend's experience. And so I think it's great counter-programming. I hope it doesn't get lost. I hope this movie does well enough.
No, it's not okay. It's not okay. I went to a 6 p.m. showing at the Alamo Draft House here in Austin, and there were a lot of seats filled, you know? I was sitting next to a dude, as I was telling you before, there was some guy who was there with his friends, but he likes to sit in the third row, which is where I like to sit. So I was sitting next to this guy, and I was like, but I had the seat next to mine was open because my wife, I bought a seat for my wife. She's like, I want to go see that shit.
Aww.
She had no interest in it. So I was like, I was like leaning over into her seat, like just to kind of give the guy next to me some space during the scenes, during the erotic scenes. I'm like, you know, I didn't want to make him feel uncomfortable.
With your uncomfortable, like adjusting and shifting. That, yeah.
I'm like, yeah, all right, yeah, oh, yes, we've all got repressed desires, okay.
You know, it's a dark theater, that's what it's for, come on. Let's be a little more friendly. It's the holidays, come on, man.
Yeah, I know is that in your next review, Stephen, I'm going to make you drink a glass of milk.
Oh, boy.
Well, I was worried about that scene, because what if she's lactose intolerant?
I know, that could keep her up all night, but maybe that's...
Well, and it also would just make their hotel room tryst really unpleasant for him.
Look, you know what? What I think is kind of interesting is I think Nicole Kidman is very good in this movie, which is not very good. I think there's a lot of good stuff in it, but there are a lot of weird tonal adjustments, which we've kind of spoken to. And her character, she plays very discombobulated. Like she seems very confused and it makes sense. It's a good acting instinct for this kind of material. And I think she acquits herself quite well. She makes it more interesting than I think it might be in another actor's hands.
She's more confused than Lily Rose Depp is under the spell of Nosferatu.
With less convulsing, except for that finger scene. But
yeah, they're actually kind of the same movie in a lot of ways. All right, Stephen Garrett, Baby Girl is in theaters now. I'm sure Stephen saw it 3 years ago at some film festival, but you can see it now like a normal person. And we'll talk to you in the new year, Stephen. Happy New Year, man.
Happy New Year.
All right. Thank you, Stephen. Baby Girl is in theaters now, as is Nosferatu. We talked to Stephen about both of those. And thanks to Jim Arndorfer for talking to me about A Complete Unknown, which is terrific and is in theaters now as well. I am Neil Pollack. I'm the editor-in-chief of Book and Film Globe, www.bookandfilmglobe.com. I have been editing this site for 7 years, and in 2025, it will be my eighth. And I'm going to keep doing it until they tell me I can't anymore. It's a great site. It's a great gig. I love this podcast. I love you all, even if I don't know you. And I thank you so much for your patronage. Happy New Year, and I will talk to you soon.
Original production.
The Bookhouse is an independent bookstore with two locations in New Jersey, Millburn and Long Branch. Are you the guy who says they like to support indie bookstores? Good. Then be that guy. Come shop at The Bookhouse. Books, puzzles, games, coffee, cards, live author events, comedy nights, and most important, a real sense of community where actual human beings engage with one another. The Bookhouse in downtown Millburn and at Pier Village in Long Branch. That's The Bookhouse. Independent, local, quaint as fuck. Follow us on Instagram and come visit our stores.